This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for your weekly podcast, Into England's Past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can automatically download new episodes to your chosen device every Thursday. Just tap subscribe for weekly updates. Now, this month marks 100 years since the death of the Antarctic explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton, who is commemorated by a blue plaque at his former home in London. In fact, he's among six men who've received the same honour for their commitments to polar exploration, mapping the globe, and pushing the limits of human endurance. Joining us to talk about their exploits is senior historian for the Blue Plaque Scheme, Howard Spencer.
Hello, Charles. Nice to be back.
Let's start off then with our first person from history, who is Sir James Clark Ross, born in 1800, died in 1862. He precedes some of the more well-known names, such as Scott and Shackleton, which people might have heard of. Sir James Clark Ross, how did he become a polar explorer?
Well, you could say it was in the blood, really, because his uncle, Sir John Ross, was also a polar explorer and, like him, a naval officer. And in fact, this was James Clark Ross's first experience of polar exploration, was going aboard the ship Isabella in 1818 with his uncle. On that expedition, they rediscovered Baffin Bay in Canada. They were engaged in early attempts to look for the Northwest Passage, which became this kind of holy grail for explorers around this time. That was an attempt to find a route round the north of Canada that would go to Asia and on to India. We'll be saying more about that as this chat goes on, I'm sure.
Indeed. We will talk about the Northwest Passage with one of our other figures from history a little bit later on, but regarding Sir James Clark Ross's key achievements, what would you list them as?
Well, he proved that Boothia was an island rather than a peninsula. This was on the 1828 Victory trip, which was also undertaken with his uncle. He went on four other expeditions to the Arctic with William Parry. And June 1831, he located the magnetic North Pole. Rather later on, he skippered his own expedition to Antarctica between 1839 and 43, on which he discovered Victoria Land, Mount Erebus, the Ross Ice Shelf, which obviously was named after him, the Ross Sea, and Ross's Gull, which is a Antarctic seabird, is also named after him.
And it's interesting that he's done both the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere as an explorer.
That's right. Well, he did cover both, as in quite a number of them that we're talking about do that. I should say that he captained the first attempt to look for Sir John Franklin, who was famously lost and trapped in yet another attempt to find the Northwest Passage. And this was in 1849.
But how did he pave the way for other explorers? You've reeled off a list of key achievements there, Magnetic North being quite an important one. But why was his work so important to others who followed?
Well, I guess he showed, if nothing else, he showed where the Northwest Passage wasn't. So, I mean, that was one thing, I guess. And he also wrote up his findings in a book called A Voyage of Discovery and Research in the Southern and Antarctic Regions, which came out in 1847. So that was pretty important as a sort of, you know, a basic text, I suppose, and an explanation of what he found for further explorers who came later.
His knighthood then was, I suppose, fairly well deserved based on the work that he'd done.
Yes, I mean, interestingly, he turned one down, turned it down once, and then accepted it a bit later on. I mean, it was given for basically for his work in both polar regions. That was it. That was the reason he got it.
And if we look at his blue plaque then, this is at 2 Elliot Place, Blackheath in London.
Well, yes, it's southeast London, which is famously a bit of a tube desert. So you're on the overland stuff, but it's Blackheath railway station would get you there. It's a lovely spot which actually faces the Blackheath, the actual sort of open grassed area, exactly the sort of area you would expect somebody like James Clark Ross at that time to have wanted to live, really.
Yeah, what kind of property is it? What sort of style?
It's a Georgian three-storey house. Not massively opulent, but you know, nice enough. You'd take it as a gift. And the plaque went up in 1960, and it commemorates Ross's stay there between 1843 and 5, which was just after his marriage to Anne Coleman. Anne Coleman, who he promised he wouldn't go on any further polar expeditions after they married. In fact, she released him from the promise in order that he could go on this attempt to look for Sir John Franklin.
Right, OK. It's interesting that the plaque went up almost 100 years after he died. He died in 1862. What was the reason, really, for the blue plaque going up?
Well, it's the reason that any plaque goes up, really, which is public suggestion. Somebody suggested it might be a good idea, and the council said, OK, well, we'll do that then, because it was done by the London County Council in those days. So essentially, there's sort of no great grandmaster plan in this. It's really comes down to who suggests stuff and what the council decide to do.
Now, you just mentioned that his wife allowed him to go on a further trip and withdrew her promise. So did he die, shall we say, of natural causes or?
Yes, he died at his home in Aston Abbots in Buckinghamshire, which is where he and Anne lived latterly. She actually predeceased him by 5 years, and he was apparently never really the same after her death. They were very close, very attached.
So moving on to John Ray now, who is our next explorer. Born in 1813, died in 1893. His plaque was erected at 4 Lower Addison Gardens in Holland Park, which is quite a very nice area, actually, of London, West London, I believe. He was a Scotsman, though, as well as being an Arctic explorer. So how was he drawn to exploration? Was it to do with the fact that he was born up in the wilds of Scotland?
It may have had something to do with it. He certainly was in the far north. He was actually an Orcadian.
So Orkney.
Yeah. And he trained in medicine. He joined the Hudson Bay Company, who, as the name would imply, a trading company based in Canada around Hudson Bay. He was originally a surgeon aboard one of their ships, and he then moved on to being a surgeon at one of their stations on Hudson Bay. And it was there that he learned the rudiments of surveying. And actually, that's, I guess, the sort of key that got him into exploration generally was mapping large areas of coastline. He did a big survey of the North American North Coast in 1846-7, and then another one in 1853-4. In all, he mapped about 1,700 miles of coastline, which is pretty extraordinary, given that he did, you know, a lot of this on foot. Yeah, he really was a very considerable and underrated figure.
So like Sir James Clark Ross before him, he was sort of paving the way for future explorers by doing the map work.
Well, that's right, filling in the last gaps in the map in that particular region. That's exactly right.
What other key achievements of his exploration would there have been?
Well, he discovered that King William's Island was an island. He also, very, very importantly, discovered where the Northwest Passage, which had long been sort of mythically described, actually went through. He didn't actually traverse it himself in a boat. That was Roald Amundsen much later. But this was in 1853-4. He actually identified where it was. And therefore, many people believe he should actually be credited with the discovery of it.
This Northwest Passage is actually quite an important aspect to John Ray's story, isn't it? Because there's another person who is not featured in our six men with blue plaques, who is a chap called Sir John Franklin. He went on an expedition to find the Northwest Passage, this route from North American waters across to Asian waters via Canada. Now, what is John Ray's connection to the disappearance of Sir John Franklin's expedition?
Well, it was Ray who found out what had happened to the Franklin expedition, which was that they had become stuck in pack ice and they'd essentially died of starvation. And he discovered this via the local Inuit tribes, who told him that there was a sort of a group of Europeans who had died of starvation. They told him where it was. He didn't actually go and look himself, but knowing that there were other expeditions looking in entirely the wrong place for Franklin, he went back to London and reported his findings. Unfortunately, this didn't go down well. I mean, he was basically, it was a case of shooting the messenger, really. He brought bad news, including the information that the Inuit passed on, that the desperate crew had resorted to cannibalism, which we now know they did. But this, really? This didn't go down well at all. It was at the time, it was very much, well, these are men of the Royal Navy, and they'd never have done anything like that. And Franklin's widow was in particular very upset, and she found Ray, as she put it, hairy and disagreeable. And as a result, he found himself at the centre of what we would today call a media storm, really. A lot of people weighed in saying he was this and that, including Charles Dickens. And he was also accused of having only come back to London to claim the £10,000 reward, which he said quite plausibly that he didn't know anything about. And actually, it's very likely he wouldn't have known anything about it because he'd been off in Canada. He did take the money, but he did also share it with his subordinates. And it did leave him with a degree of financial independence later.
Where did this £10,000 reward come from then?
Well, this came from the Admiralty. They put it up for anybody to try and find out what had happened to Franklin.
But he came back, listening to what you're saying now, he came back without evidence. He came back with oral testimony.
There were items that the Inuits were able to produce, which indicated that they were from Franklin's ship. So there was that. It wasn't simply, he didn't simply take their word for it. But he was criticised for not himself going on to have a look. But to do that, he would have had to spend another winter in the Arctic, and that wasn't really practical. So that was one of a number of rather unreasonable criticisms that were thrown his way.
I see. So I can kind of understand why he came back to deliver the news instead. Well, I feel sorry for John Ray, really, but...
Well, he's getting his recognition now. He didn't get his blue plaque until 2011. And I think this partly was because he did get into sort of bad odour for this. And it must be said, too, that he wasn't shy about criticising the Royal Navy for their own exploration methods. And that didn't go down well either. He was himself very keen to learn from the Inuit and how they survived in the Arctic conditions. And of course, you know, why wouldn't you do that? Well, I mean, at the time, there was a sort of a sense abroad that these people were savages and that you shouldn't be dealing with them. And that was a prejudice that Ray didn't share, and he sort of suffered because of it. I mean, he did things like, he used snowshoes, which the Inuit did. He was taught by them to find the crawberries that grew under the snow cover, which you could eat, and that would protect you from getting scurvy. So it was all sort of survivalist stuff that he learned from the Inuit, who had a name for him. They called him Agluka, meaning he who takes long strides. So they rated him, even if people back here didn't at that time. But as I say, I mean, he is now at long last getting some of the recognition he deserves. His ancestral home, which is the Hall of Clestrain on Orkney, is currently being restored by a trust that's been set up in his name, which is really good news. And as I say, it was really, really good to see his plaque go up in 2011. I was there. Ray Mears unveiled it, which is entirely appropriate. Another great contemporary...
A survivalist, yes.
Yep. Expert. And it must also be said that in terms of blue plaques, we do like to commemorate quite good connections between person and building. And you've got a bit of a problem, of course, with Arctic and Antarctic explorers, because it's in the job description that they're going to be away rather a lot. But in the case of John Ray, he actually comes back to London in 1869 with Alicia Thompson, his wife, who he meets and marries in Canada while he's there. He lives in 4 Lower Addison Gardens, as it is now. It's been renumbered since he lived there. But he lives there for 24 years. So it's a really good long connection. And he has a really fruitful retirement. And he really gets a lot out of living in London and the sort of intellectual stimulus. And he's kind of belongs to lots of learned societies. He walks from his home in Holland Park to the learned societies in Westminster and so on, thinks absolutely nothing of that. Well, I mean, he wouldn't, would he?
Yes, I heard that story.
1,700 miles of coastline in North America. So it wouldn't really seem such a big deal for him. But yeah, it was really good to see that one go up.
Definitely. Was the delay partly down to more time passing and a more circumspect, considered view being taken around his reputation?
Again, I don't think anybody had actually thought to put him forward before. I mean, he was put forward a few years before that. I mean, it does take a while for these things in the gestation, as it were, but I don't think he'd actually come up as a possibility shortly before the plaque went up in 2011. Just a few years before that, he would have been put forward to our blue plaques panel that decide who gets the awards, and they decided that he deserved it, and so it was.
So he had this rather nice retirement in London, did plenty of walking in and out of the city, into town, as they call it, I know, via Holland Park, which is in West London. I think you could probably visit that plaque quite easily on the Central Line.
Yes, that's right. Yes, you'd go to, I think probably Shepherd's Bush would be the nearest tube there.
Or Holland Park, I guess, yeah.
Fairly short walk from both of those.
What kind of property is it?
It's an early 19th century terrace, a fairly ordinary house of that type. A bit less grand than James Clark Ross's one in Blackheath.
How did he die then? He had this, obviously, retirement, so I presume he...
He died at home. He was 80 when he died, so yes, it was a good age.
Well, let's move on to Robert Falcon Scott. He was born in 1868, died in 1912. We'll get on to how in a little bit. And he's associated with a property at 56 Oakley Street in Chelsea, which we'll talk about as well. Now, Scott of the Antarctic, quite a famous name, Robert Falcon Scott is the full name. He was part of this five-man team that went to the South Pole and Antarctica. This included Edward Adrian Wilson and Lawrence Oates, who we're going to talk about individually straight after. But before we talk about their expedition, could you describe briefly the background of these men and how they came together?
This is part of the sort of the final team that went to the pole. I mean, the entire expedition was much larger, something like 60 odd people who actually sort of descended on the Antarctic in all. So these were part of the sort of final push to the pole. Oates had an army background. The rest of them were all, three of them were seamen. Edgar Evans was a naval seaman. Henry Robertson Bowers was a merchant seaman. Scott himself was a navy man. Edward Adrian Wilson was a trained scientist who'd been to Cambridge and so on. So they had slightly disparate backgrounds, I guess, chosen for sort of particular expertises and so on for the final push to the pole.
And when did they set off for the South Pole? Because it's around 1912 that fate has a role.
They set off from Great Britain on the 15th of June 1910, which gives you an idea about just how long these things take or took in those days, the original sort of voyage out. It was an incredibly long-term and incredibly complicated endeavour.
We know they reached Antarctica, obviously, and this was part of a mission for this team to become the first in the world to reach the South Pole. So did they succeed in reaching the South Pole?
They did, but they got their second. When they got to Antarctica, they discovered that Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer who'd already discovered the Northwest Passage in 1905, that he was already there and poised to launch a strike at the pole. They actually met there. They were kind of pretty astonished, as you can imagine, to find him. And Amundsen was apparently very affable and invited them to sort of, you know, invited to help them with their care of the dogs and stuff like that, and offered them, you know, sort of showed them a site they could camp. And in fact, they refused that and went away and set up their base camp somewhere else. And Scott wrote that he thought the best thing to do was to forget that the encounter had ever happened.
Wow. They were really disappointed then.
I think it was a kick in the teeth. I mean, they'd already had a number of setbacks in sort of setting the expedition up. They'd encountered very stormy seas on the way over from New Zealand and so on, and things had already started to go somewhat awry.
And I suppose that was the start of perhaps their luck running out. People who will know the story will know what happens next, but for people who don't, tell us what did happen to Robert Falcon Scott, Edward Adrian Wilson and Lawrence Oates and a couple of other men.
They did get to the pole in January 1912, but when they got there, they discovered a flag and a tent with a note in it from Amundsen's team indicating that they got there 34 days before, which is going some and indicates how Amundsen and his team, which was based on husky dogs, were a lot quicker across the ice, a lot more effective, and probably chose the better route. They then began the weary trudge back, having left supply depots along the way, and eventually died in a tent 11 miles short of their major supply depot. So it ended in a great deal of tragedy. Two of the party died first. Edgar Evans died after sustaining a head injury. And then Oates, who we'll talk about in detail a bit later, but he got frostbite.
Why were they short of reaching their supply sort of rendezvous? Was it bad weather or?
They basically succumbed to exhaustion and the weather. The run-up to that was that there were problems with, they'd chosen to rely more heavily on pony transport and on motorized sleds. The ponies selected didn't prove up to the task. The motorized sleds broke down. So they basically had to do a great deal more man hauling than was originally intended. the result of which is that they were exhausted by the time they got to the section of the trek where they were actually intending to do the man hauling. So this, it basically didn't leave them with a lot in the tank. I think that this was essentially the problem, as I understand it. There's an enormous amount of literature about this, and Scott's had his critics and his defenders. I mean, I think it is probably generally accepted that there was some elements of poor planning in it, and that clearly, you know, it didn't work out the way it was supposed to.
So were they kind of beaten by the weather, beaten by being, I suppose, crestfallen at the disappointment of not finding the pole first? And then obviously lots of other things didn't work out as well. The equipment let them down, ponies let them down. I suppose their energy levels dropped, their supplies dropped. Did they just all die of starvation and cold?
Yeah, essentially, that was it. I mean, actually, Scott did order Wilson, who was the sort of the medical man on the final push, to issue everybody with 30 opium tablets. So they did actually have a means of ending it that way, should they have chosen to do so. But they didn't do that. They basically died of cold and starvation, very sadly.
And how do we even know that, you know, this is what happened to them? Because did an expedition go out to go and find them?
They were eventually found, that's right. Basically, the people that found them, they just built a cairn over the tent, fashioned some skis into a cross over it, and that's effectively where they remain. I mean, these days they're buried under about 20 metres of ice because of the blizzards and so on that have happened since. So that's where they remain.
Edward Adrian Wilson was among that group who died on that expedition in 1912. His plaque is erected at Battersea Vicarage, 42 Vicarage Crescent in Battersea. Now, looking at the timeline of these blue plaques, Scott and Wilson were both honoured with blue plaques in 1935, but Lawrence Oates only in 1973. It strikes me as rather odd that they weren't all recognised at the same time, given that they died all at the same time. Any reasons for that?
I think it was just that in 1935, nobody thought to suggest Oates. Plus, I guess Wilson was rather more important to the expedition and a rather more important figure in polar exploration. I mean, Oates's significance is really owing to the you know, the story of his demise more than anything else. And, you know, Wilson was the chief scientist and he was Scott's main confidant on the expedition. I mean, that's why I think those two were probably chosen at that time. I don't know the definite details of that. The records are silent, as they say, on that, but I suspect that's the reason.
But in some respects, Lawrence Oates's noble act of self-sacrifice is the story that I think many people will know just from popular culture, even if they don't have an interest in history or polar exploration. They'll have heard of Scott of the Antarctic being the leader, but they'll also know about Lawrence Oates, even if they don't know his name, his sacrifice. So I find that quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it is a resonant story. And for those that don't know it, I mean, basically he went out into the teeth of a blizzard with the words, "I'm just going outside now, I may be some time." And this was at a point when the rest of them knew, the three other men who are then still alive, knew that he was so badly frostbitten that he was, you know, basically holding them back. They couldn't tell him that, but he knew, and that's what he chose to do. And it's an interesting event because, of course, it also touches on changing societal attitudes to suicide, because essentially that's what it was. He wasn't going to come back and he knew that. And it was done in a higher cause. But of course, not very long before, you know, 100 years or so before, suicide was not only a mortal sin, but it was also a crime. And you couldn't be buried in a churchyard. You had to be buried in unconsecrated grounds, often at crossroads. That's the way it was until about 1820, when I think they relented enough to let suicides be buried in churchyards, but only under darkness and without a ceremony. And it wasn't until the 1880s that was relaxed a little more. And of course, you know, this is a sort of, I suppose, an ongoing debate in terms of things like euthanasia. But I think Oates's gesture, and it was a noble gesture, and that's how Scott described it at the time, you know, noble gesture of somebody who knew his own time was up, who sacrificed himself for the benefit of others. And so therefore that's why it resonates. But in terms of, I'm talking about sort of scientific achievements and you know, legacy to exploration and so on, Oates can't really be described as a major figure in that sense.
But from, I think, a human perspective, I think a lot of people who aren't scientific or just ordinary people would see that sacrifice and tip their hat in a way.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's a tremendous sort of human interest story, and it does, as I say, have greater resonances too, as I've said. And I should also say that unfortunately Oates's plaque no longer exists. It was put up in 1973, as you said, on number 309 Upper Richmond Road in Putney, but the building was demolished. And this brings to the fore an aspect of the scheme, which is that fortunately or unfortunately, the plaques don't actually provide any statutory protection. They are completely different from the listing system, which does do that. So while they are a badge, they indicate that something interesting happened somewhere or someone interesting lived there. It doesn't prevent buildings from being demolished. And since the scheme began in 1866, around 100 plaques have been lost to demolition. And our usual policy in such cases is to look for another building lived in by that person and try and re-erect either the same plaque or if it's been damaged or anything or the inscription's no longer appropriate, then we'll put up a different one. And that does happen from time to time. Unfortunately, in Oates's case, that was really the only London building that he's connected with. His major connection was with Gestingthorpe Hall in Essex, but he was actually born in Putney and lived, I think, the first 11 years or so of his life there. So it was a decent connection. And there is now a Putney Society plaque on the site of the building that replaced what was there. But English Heritage doesn't put our plaques on sites. It only has to be the actual building. I mean, for a charity that's concerned with built heritage, it seems right for us to be insistent about it being the original building. After that, the really strong connection has gone once the building's gone. That's the view that's been taken.
I suppose, though, there is at least that memory by that group of people in Putney who have recognised.
Yeah, I mean, it's good that he is commemorated. I mean, I think this is why there's room for more schemes other than ours, and there's plenty of others operating. And I'm glad that there's something there to commemorate him.
Yes.
There's actually something there to commemorate Henry Robertson Bowers too, who had a connection to Streatham. And I believe there's a private plaque on his old school in Streatham.
And Bowers was part of that five-man crew.
He was part of the five-man push, yes. He was one of the other members.
Worth saying as well that Lawrence Oates's plaque was demolished in 2000, so fairly recently, really.
I don't know whether there was any kind of outcry or attempt to save the building. I suspect there may have been something, but it's really a kind of a planning decision. The plaque is actually in our store. We have a store at Rest Park, which is one of the English Heritage properties.
Bedfordshire.
In Bedfordshire, correct. And the plaque is in store there. At some point, it might be nice to display it, maybe some of the other orphaned plaques that have come off buildings which have no other place to go. So that's something that we might consider doing.
I think you've just given us an idea for another podcast, Howard. The ghosts of blue plaques, yes. Well, that sort of concludes our discussion about Lawrence Oates then and his selfless act and the fact that his London property is no longer standing and was demolished in 2000. But regarding his two other expedition mates, Edward Adrian Wilson and Robert Falcon Scott, they were connected to Battersea and Chelsea. What kind of properties are there plaques still on?
Well, Scott, his plaque is in Oakley Street in Chelsea, actually a few doors down from where we unveiled a plaque to Bob Marley in 2019. So it's at 56 Oakley Street, and it's a terrace of 19th century houses on a road that goes down to a river crossing, which actually goes over into Battersea Park. And it marks a house where he lived with his mother just before he got married. This was in the Edwardian period for about 2 or 3 years. It was rented by them.
And Edward Adrian Wilson as well?
His is on Battersea Vicarage, which is 42 Vicarage Crescent, Battersea. That's where he was from 1895 to 8. And he was there as part of a sort of university settlement. He was a very committed Christian, and he was there to sort of do good works in the Battersea area. Unfortunately, he caught TB while he was there, which does make it all the more remarkable that he then went on to go on a major Antarctic expedition.
Yes, definitely. Well, that's the sort of Scott of the Antarctic crew. But if we move on to another famous name, Sir Ernest Shackleton, who was born in 1874, died in 1922. He's connected to Lewisham, and I gather he's also Irish.
That's right. Yes, he was born in County Kildare. His father was a doctor who moved the family to Sydenham when Ernest was a small child. And he lived there in what was then called Aberdeen House. It was then 12 West Hill, Sydenham, now called Westwood Hill, Sydenham. And while there, Shackleton went to prep school, and he then went on to Dulwich College, where he's extensively remembered and commemorated.
So, as you say, his boyhood home was in Sydenham, and this is where the blue plaque is. This was erected in 1928.
That's right. Only 6 years after he died. We now have a rule of have to wait 20 years after somebody's passed, but it does, it's a measure of his celebrity at the time, the fact that they put it up so soon after his death.
About the circumstances of his death, for people who don't know, how did Shackleton die?
Well, he died on a final sort of sub-Antarctic expedition to South Georgia. He had a heart attack and he was only in his late 40s, but I think by that time the privations of his earlier expeditions had caught up with him a bit, sadly.
So what was it about his childhood in Sydenham that would have given us a clue that he was going to become an explorer one day?
Well, he wasn't conventionally academic, although he was interested in things like poetry. I mean, he caused some consternation on an early sort of merchant navy voyages by taking volumes of poetry on board with him, which wasn't actually that usual. But as a child, there were more sort of palpable signs that he was a fairly adventurous character. He used to enjoy climbing on the roof of the house in Sydenham, which has got a very steep pitched roof with a sort of flat top to it.
Right.
And he used to enjoy scaling the tiles and sitting on top of the house. So there we are. That was a sort of an early sign. He was also, his major hobby at the time was carpentry. So this would have presumably come in handy later for
building shelters.
Yes, he built sheds. He built, as a child, he built adult-sized sheds for the back garden. And there was an even more palpable sign, perhaps, of what was to come when he, on one of his first merchant navy trips, he brought back a nest of alligators with him and kept them in the garden until apparently the entire domestic staff at number 12 Westwood Hill threatened resignation unless he got rid of them. So he had to.
Now, he's, as we said, quite a famous name. Born in 1874, so he's a little bit younger than Scott, who was born in 1868, but they actually had experience of each other, didn't they?
Well, yes, that's right. They went on the National Antarctica Expedition 1901-4, and Shackleton actually was sort of under Scott. He was a subordinate on that expedition, and they worked together.
And how many times did Shackleton undertake expeditions to Antarctica, particularly?
There was three large ones, and then I said this later one on which he died, which was a sort of sub-Antarctic expedition. But there was, other than that, it was 1907-9, an abortive attempt to get to the pole. And then 1914-17, which was the Endurance expedition, which was actually an attempt to traverse Antarctica, which was not successful. In fact, that wasn't done until the 1950s in the end. So it was an incredibly ambitious thing to do.
Wow.
But that's his career in a nutshell.
What were his key achievements then, would you say?
Well, probably what he's best known for is getting the entire crew of Endurance off when it got wedged in pack ice. There were 28 of them, including Shackleton. This was in 1915. And he got out by using a mixture of sledging and boats to get to Elephant Island, which was on the Antarctic coast. And then he and five others sailed 800 miles to South Georgia in the South Atlantic to organize a relief party for the others. And they all survived. They all got out, which was an extraordinary achievement. And not just down to Shackleton, it has to be said. There was a navigator, the captain of the Endurance, was Frank Worsley, who was a New Zealander. And the navigational feat of finding South Georgia, which remember is a fairly small island in the middle of the South Atlantic, and he's trying to use, you know, theodolites and all the rest of it while there's the yaw and the movement of the boat. And they did actually manage to hit it, which was pretty extraordinary. And they did it in the nick of time. They had supplies for a month and they got there in a month and they were basically, you know, they were fairly close to death by the time they got there. And when they did get to South Georgia, they actually landed on the wrong side of the island because there was a storm raging and they just had to get ashore because of the state of some of the men. Shackleton and two others, including Worsley, then walked across the interior of South Georgia, which had actually never been done before. And they did it without maps. They had no maps. They just had to sort of feel their way towards Stromness, which is the whaling station where they knew they could get help. And then, in the words of Shackleton, three scarecrows walked into the whaling station and gave the Norwegian whalers there a bit of a shock. And goodness from then me. On, the relief organisation was organised. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's his major achievement, and that's why he's fairly heavily celebrated today. I mean, again, it's a great story of exploration and a human interest story, and he got them out alive. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary.
Exactly. This was all back in 1915, so just 3 years after the deaths of Oates, Wilson and Scott, and the two other men in the Scott's to South Pole voyage. So I suppose those deaths and those tragedies would have been quite fresh in his mind as he came up with his plan to reach that whaling station eventually.
That's right. I mean, I think he'd shown a certain degree of caution before. I mean, I say his own attempt to get to the pole, and he did get fairly close. And this was in the 1907-09 expedition, failed. And he turned around when he realised it wasn't going to work. So he turned around before disaster hit, basically. And he said when he got back to England, to his wife in 1909, desperately disappointed about not having made it to the pole, he said, better a living donkey than a dead lion. So that was his kind of attitude.
Well, I kind of like Shackleton's wisdom and the fact that he lived to tell the tale on his own. So what were the circumstances of Shackleton's death eventually in 1922?
Well, this was on his final sub-Antarctic expedition, which was to sort of go around some of the islands on the Antarctic coast, and he got as far as South Georgia, the place he'd been rescued from and by accident got to know really rather well.
And he has this heart attack.
He died there of a heart attack, yeah, and in his late 40s. I mean, I think probably the privations of previous expeditions had caught up with him.
Was his body brought back to the UK?
No, he was buried on South Georgia.
So another one who sort of had a poetic ending in a way. So we've charted, when we look back at all this, six key figures in the history of both Arctic and Antarctic exploration, all of whom are recognised with their blue plaques in London at their former homes. To what extent would you say did they help to further our understanding of the polar regions and of the globe as a whole? If we look at some of our earlier figures, they were very important because they were key to map making. So that's one thing.
That's very important. Obviously, that kind of helps to lay the ground for future developments. There was also the scientific observations that they produced, which are of ongoing importance for things that concern us now, such as, you know, the retreat of polar ice and all that kind of stuff, which has now become startlingly relevant to us, of course. So they were all pioneering figures in their own way, essentially.
Yes. And I suppose another thing we've just touched on now is caution. Shackleton was perhaps a more cautious explorer than the others. Would that be a fair thing to say, that perhaps he learnt from the others' mistakes?
That's right. Well, I'm absolutely Cherry Garrard, who was the guy that wrote up the whole history of polar exploration, really, or this part of it, in the 1920s, who'd been on the Scott expedition, but not part of the final push. He said that, you know, Shackleton was the one you wanted to lead you if you were in a hole, because of that sort of degree of caution, I guess, and care for the people in his charge. So, yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
And lastly, Howard, how would you sort of look back on this period of relatively recent human history in the last century or back into the 1800s as well? It's a really important time for the nation, isn't it? It's really pushing the boundaries of knowledge. Well before the space race of recent decades, these were sort of the heroes, the men who had the right stuff, of the 1800s and early 1900s, who were really exploring regions of planet Earth that hadn't been explored before. They were the pioneers of a new kind of exploration, and, you know, the furthest tips of the northern and southern hemisphere were that. So I suppose that's quite a remarkable thing. That sort of places this in context, in a way, for the modern person.
It was the final frontier, absolutely. Yes, it was at that time. You know, if you want to use the Star Trek phrase, it was the Antarctica was the final frontier, and the Arctic regions too. And these were people that willingly took large risks in order for that sort of thrill of adventure and discovery. And of course, I mean, there was you can't forget the trading imperatives too. I mean, this urge to find the Northwest Passage was partly about the sort of imperial urge to trade and to expand the empire and so on. That's part of the story too. But there is a sort of the pure adventure side of it as well. I mean, all these people we talked about were pretty extraordinary individuals. They weren't, in many cases, very clubbable. They weren't particularly drawn to society. They didn't mind being in isolated places and faraway places for long periods of time. But they were all pioneers in their own way.
Yes, and they were willing to take on extraordinary risks and potentially pay with it with their lives, as some of them did.
Indeed.
So I think that's really worth doffing our caps to, in a way.
Absolutely, yes.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll hear about the winter traditions that arrive after Christmas.
Wassailing is the Southern English version of a whole complex of customs. To bless a house and a farm, to make the place feel fortunate and happy.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.